This podcast is sponsored by AAA, the American Automobile Association. AAA members get discounts on tickets, resort accommodations, and more at Walt Disney World and other Orlando attractions. If you book a qualifying Walt Disney World Resort vacation package at select AAA offices, you'll receive a free subscription to touringplans.com, as well as dedicated trip planning resources just for AAA clients. Go to AAA.com or ask your local AAA travel agent for more details on this offer. Welcome back to another edition of the Unofficial Guide Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. I'm Len Testa, and today we'll be recording in Frontierland in Disneyland. And Jim and I will be walking through the history of this very important land in the park. I'd like to welcome Jim back to the show. Jim, how are you?
Howdy!
All right, so Jim and I are sitting right now. We're going to start our episode at Rancho del Zocalo, which is my favorite sit-down restaurant or counter-service restaurant in the park. I really like it here. Jim, let me ask you a question. What was Frontierland like when the park first opened?
Well, it was, honestly, the luckiest part of the park. I mean, think about it. You know, this was 1955, and Disneyland television show debuted in 54. And what was the big hit from, you know, that era? The Davy Crockett. So, you know, that you literally could power the side of the park on the back of Davy Crockett. In fact,
coonskin caps everywhere.
Oh, God. You know, in
really,
fact,
were there?
Well, I mean, you know, Fess Parker and Buddy Ebsen actually turned up for the opening and did a number of promotional appearances in 55, 56, and 57. That coupled with the fact that, you know, you had Zorro on ABC television, which was a hit for the two-plus seasons that it ran, and, you know, Guy Williams would also come out to the park. So this was... this was exciting for kids of the 1950s. I mean, you know, and again, that was the height of the television western. So you could now actually, you went from seeing it on television, you know, to walking the streets here.
Wow.
And it was a very big deal. It was a very big hit. And not to say that there wasn't a learning curve. You know, for example, one of the things they used to do was gun battles in the streets. And they
just like Compton now.
Boy, this is a bad transition. But the,
sorry.
The villain was Black Bart.
The villain was Flavor Flint. No, never
mind. But literally, they would stage gun battles where they'd race across the building, you know, the tops here, and, you know, shoot each other. And it was great fun. The kids, you know, enjoyed it tremendously. That coupled with the fact that you had the Golden Horseshoe Review, which,
right.
Honestly, one of Walt's favorite things in the park. That whenever Walt was in the park, and whether it was, you know, he was bringing, you know, the president or whoever he was bringing through, you could always count on there was a certain track that people, you know, Walt would follow. That he'd, you know, take them to the Jungle Cruise and invariably end the visit by taking them to the Golden Horseshoe, to his own personal booth. Just Walt just loved the hell out of that show. And, you know, and in fact, it was one of these things where, you know, in fact, Wally Boeb tells this great story about he was 2 or 3 years in. Again, because Wally took this job because he said, okay, it's going to be 3, 4, 5 weeks. And, you know, I'm a performer and I'll just move on. And it's 2 or 3 years in and it's like, okay. And, you know, Walt comes through and really enjoys the show and, you know, and pulls Wally aside, and your contract's coming up for negotiation. And Wally leans in, and yeah, said, "Be sure and ask for a really big raise." You know, because it was one of these things where it's like, "I love it, so you're going to stay here. You can stay here as long as you like." And Wally actually, you know, I mean, you know, you think about when performers have a dressing room, Wally just basically changed it into where he lived. I mean, he would. You know, he was up there when he wasn't on stage playing Pecos Bill. He was back in his room using, you know, putting together Heath kit, you know, things with soldering irons. He was a stereo enthusiast. I mean, you'd go up to his room, it was wall-to-wall speakers. And he was
really?
Like, you know, I mean, forget about quadraphonic sound. You know, there was wall-to-phonic sound. I mean, 1,200 speakers. I'm going to make the ping pong ball go all over the room. But again, he and Betty Taylor and Fulton Burley, they just loved this gig. You know, but it got to the point where, you know, Wally would be in his dressing room and got it down, figured out. And in fact, that's the other thing that's kind of intriguing. His dressing room wasn't in Frontierland. It was over the stores in Main Street, USA.
Really?
And he'd be, he'd be in his dressing room and realize, oh, it's 6 minutes to showtime. And he had this route, which actually involved walking on rocks. I mean, he'd be in his you know, Pecos Bill or traveling salesman costume, walking through the jungles of Adventureland, and just literally the Jungle Cruise would go by. Here's this traveling salesman. Well, and he's traveling, so
sure, why not?
Stepping on rocks that they had put in the river deliberately to make it easy for him to get on stage. But no, he loved it here. He you know, just in fact, when they finally shut it down after, you know, 25 plus years of doing it, you know, 30,000 performances, you know, I mean, Wally, you know, what he loved about it was Walt would constantly reach out. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, Wally, you know, helped me write the Tiki Room show, or in fact, that's the saddest thing. When Walt passed away, there were a lot of people who actually kind of resented the fact that Wally was Walt's fair-haired boy. That, you know, whenever he was doing something, I mean, for example, if you watch, you know, The Absent-Minded Professor, a lot of the sequence in that movie where Keenan Wynn has flubber on his shoes and mm-hmm. flying up in the air, the person who's doing the jumping, going up in that's Wally.
Oh, really?
I mean, he hired him, you know, he's wearing a Keenan Wynn mask to do that. And Wally actually was the first voice of Tigger for the Winnie the Pooh movies.
Really?
And, you know, he recorded the song, he did the vocals, but as soon as Walt passed away, it was one of these things where it's like, people at the studio who had been resenting his input and his control kind of, well, you know, I think we're going to go with Paul Winchell. And, you know, all those shows you're going to write for Walt Disney World, we're not going to do that. I mean, that's another part of the Disney theme park story I don't think that gets talked about a lot, is that Walt was the daddy. All right, and to be honest, the family, the artists, it was kind of a very dysfunctional family. But as long as Daddy was in place,
yeah.
He would, you know, he'd control their input. He would, you know, and in fact, Walt kind of enjoyed pitting people against one another, you know, just to see what you'd get out of the friction. So again, we talked about Claude Coates and Mark Davis working together on the Haunted Mansion. Mark was actually brought in to do to add humor to the Jungle Cruise because it was just too dry, too academic. It needed fun. And that went so well that Walt turned to him and said, well, you know, we've got this mine train through Nature's Wonderland ride over in Frontierland. That, again, opening day attraction that was kind of a bust because you were going by these faux scenes. More to the point, you know, it was the mine train plus a stagecoach, which got jerked out of the park probably within the first year.
Really?
Well, the thing is that the story we talked about earlier, the Disneyland learning curve. When you take a actual stagecoach and drive it through a theme park, there was one particularly hellacious accident where the stagecoach, the axle came off, it overturned, and there were some people hurt. And that was it. It went out of the park. But that was one of the kinetics. That was, you know, the stagecoach driving through.
Sure, what's the Old West without a stagecoach,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so, but likewise, the buckboards, the horses. And this was Walt going, look, I need this place to tell stories. And I need it to tell stories that move a lot of people through an hour.
Was the stagecoach moving a lot of people through?
No, not at all. Again, you're 12 passengers at a time. In fact, you know, they actually had to cut down on the number of passengers originally. And again, just think about this from a logistics and lawyer's point of view. When the stagecoach first ran through Disneyland, you could ride on the inside or you could ride up top.
Ugh.
You know?
Never again.
No, but that's it exactly.
It'll never happen in another American theme park.
You know, but
can you imagine the waiver that you would have to sign these days?
God.
In order to do that? I mean, not only would you sign a waiver, there'd be like a 1-hour-long training course you'd have to do.
Absolutely.
There'd be a video, and then you'd be stapled in by your jeans.
but that's it exactly. But that, again, that was what Frontierland was all about. This was, you know, the learning curve of how do you... It's one thing to, again, to build a theme park and open it, but then it's the notion of, okay... And this was back in the day when Disneyland, in the fall and the spring, would only be open 5 days a week.
Right.
And then, you know, summer season and for the holidays, it would be open 7 days a week. And because nobody had ever done this before. It's like, well, what do you do? I mean, for example, one of the other aspects of the Mine Trains of Nature's of Wonderland, they actually had a burro ride where, you know, you...
A burro, like a mule.
Like a mule. But, you know, the miniature burros, and they would send them out 10 at a time, strung together. And what wound up happening was that when they began to load Mark Davis's audio animatronic animals in, there was this one particular burrow who had been a great lead burrow. You know, again, because you put 10 tourists in the back of burrows and they go over the same route. They do it 10 or 15 different times and then go back out to the Pony Ranch, which again, used to exist out back here. Owen Pope used to. That, in fact, was one of the very first things Disney did when he was looking to do his theme park. He hired Owen Pope and, you know, I'm going to need horses. I'm going to need burros. I'm going to need, you know, all of these animals. And he, you know, the first, you know, first cast members out in this park were the horses. You know,
wow.
So
the burros are out there.
Burros are out there. And again, the burro came to a point in the attraction where there was a faux mountain lion. And literally, it's a stuffed mountain lion. It's on a rock. It's not moving, but it growls. All right. And the burro reaches this point, stops, you know, rears up, and the rider falls out. And this one effect ruined this burro for the attraction. That was it. He would, you know, they would bring him back to that point. He'd get to that point, and he would just stop. They could go no further. And eventually, it's like they had this poor burro this cougar phobic burro had to be. You know, it's like, all right, he's got to go live at the pony farm. He's useless to us. Then it gets a little strange because now
it gets more strange than a cougar phobic burro.
Well,
yeah, this is the part where one of us has to ask whether we're on drugs. But okay, go ahead. Should we walk?
Sure.
We're leaving Rancho de leaving the harmony of Rancho del Zocalo, my favorite place. We're gonna walk through Frontierland. These are the sacrifices we make for the show. All right, so we're walking through Frontierland. We're going to walk up towards Big Thunder Ranch, where this place was located.
Yeah, well, and that's part of the problem. That you got to understand, as the 50s give way to the 60s, the television western starts to fade.
Oh, Sputnik, right? Sputnik pretty much ends the television western, right?
That we trade the frontiersman for, you know, literally the new frontiersman, the spaceman, and so. People are less and less excited about the Frontierland aspect of the park. And more to the point, because these are, this is the first generation of audio animatronics that are featured over in Mine Train Through Nature's Wonderland. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're kind of crude. They're effective, but, you know, face it, for an audience that's going to see Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln, or who's, you know, seeing Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, an elk, you know, that's locked horns with another elk that moves back and forth and back and forth. You know, it's not all that entertaining. And meanwhile, again, you know, this is, Disney has competition in Southern California, whether it's the American Revolution at Six Flags, Magic Mountain at that point, or what's going on at Knott's Berry Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And the belief is like, look, guys, we've got to step up our game. Gets kind of interesting is that during this same period for phase two of Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom, there of course had been the Western River Project, which was going to be that park's Pirates of the Caribbean. But instead of a ride through, you know, dealing with pirates, you're now going to see, you know, all sorts of crazy Western characters.
Okay.
But it wasn't just an attraction. It was a boat ride, which featured a train ride rolling across this tabletop mesa, and it was
a train ride.
Train ride, and was
that the first idea of a Western? Was it Western themed train ride?
Well, the idea was that it was going to be a runaway mine train going through these mysterious caverns that housed the boat ride. I mean, it was a giant show building.
Got it.
Okay, and it was Tony Baxter who sort of came up with the. Well, what if we separated that out? What if we did that as, rather than a ride on top of a ride, what if we just did that as a ride? And more to the point, if we look at what's going on with Mine Train Through Nature's Wonderland, we need a thrill ride. What if we take this and drop this into the Disneyland? So he was the one who sort of refined the design. You've got the Bryce Canyon idea. And this was literally, you know, think about it. How long it had been since Disney had done anything like a coaster. I mean, the closest to that point, they had the Matterhorn, you had Space Mountain. So to finally do a coaster on this side of the park creating a sense of balance, driving people over into Frontierland after these years were, frankly, you know, things had gotten out of whack. So many people were going over to Tomorrowland, so many people going to right. Frontierland. I mean, the very thing we were talking about earlier about Bear Country, about trying to drive people over to this side of the park.
Yeah, I can't imagine Frontierland without Big Thunder in it.
Yeah, so now where it gets...
Was there a period where the mine train stopped, they stopped operating it, or they stopped operating the Western Exposition and before Big Thunder was built? Was there like a period where there was nothing back here?
No, they literally, in fact, what's kind of interesting, we go over here...
All right, we're walking past, you guys can hear Big Thunder in the background. We're walking towards Big Thunder Ranch.
Where they could, they left pieces of...
the train? Yeah, so we're walking over the bridge by Big Thunder right now. And if you look to your left, there's a cave. Yeah. And the cave looks big enough to put a ride vehicle, Jim.
And that's the whole point. This is the remaining chunk of Bear Country from...
This is Bear Country.
Bear Country from... but again, the specific Bear Country scene for Mine Train Through Nature's Wonderland. In fact, there was this very weird period in Disney history where Bear Country had actually just opened as an attraction mm-hmm. in the park, but Mine Train Through Nature's Wonderland still existed as an attraction. So you could go visit Bear Country and see the Country Bear Show, or you could ride through Bear Country on the train. And in fact, up until just recently, they actually kept some of the original effects on in this pond. The idea is you came through that cave.
Which way were you going? Towards the cave?
Towards the cave.
Towards okay. the cave. All right, so all right. From Big Thunder towards the cave.
Okay. And there were audio animatronic bears here in the pond trying to catch fish. And they had, the fish were actually still going back and forth here in the pond up until last year or thereabouts.
Really?
Yeah, and in fact, on the other side here was one of the other big set pieces for mine trains. They had Cascade Peak, which, again, was the mountain that faced out to Rivers of America. But, I don't know, Disney has had difficulties in when it comes to trying to figure out what to do with Frontierland. I mean, for example, Rivers of America, it wasn't all that long ago that they proposed a complete retheming of that area. They were actually going to get rid of... I mean, there have been these long concerns about the American Indian Village, whether or not it's offensive to Native Americans.
Sure.
And so it was actually Bruce Gordon that came up with this kind of interesting idea of just changing the Rivers of America to make it into the Rivers of American legend. For example, you'd come around the turn and here would be Paul Bunyan. And, you know, you'd have the giant, you know, his giant boot by the river. Or, you know, or you'd come around a promontory and you'd see, you know, John Henry standing there with the hammer in his hand and mm-hmm. Pecos Bill and... You know, just the notion of let's just line this riverbank with vignette. You know, the you're on the steamboat, you have Mark Twain narrating, and he just talks about all these heroes of American legend. And
it's not a bad idea.
The problem is it's passive, and in fact, for a lot of people, that's one of the reasons why they just won't get on the steamboat anymore. It's passive.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know, this placid ride. And for people who come to this park who are, you know, desperate to get in their 12 rides so they feel like they've gotten their value, you know, being trapped on a boat for 22 minutes is just, you know, something they won't do.
No, no one will do it.
But yeah, I mean, this was here, and...
So if I was to go through that tunnel, where would I end up?
Well, again, this actually took you out along the water that you
were out on.
I mean, there was this elaborate route that, you know, you went through the deserts and... saw paint pots, you went up onto the High Sierras, and again, you'd see elk battling and mountain goats, and in fact, that's kind of the saddest part of the story. When they were building Big Thunder here,
mm-hmm.
Again, you had to build up the scale of the mountain, you had to build up the scale of the land to support things, and one of the things they did to sort of gin up the height was they took all of these, you know, these moth-eaten animatronics and just sort of threw them around and threw soil on top of them. So you're walking on the cast right now, I guess.
It's a mass grave of audio animatronics.
The early audio animatronics. So if you miss that mountain lion that frightened the you know, the burrow. He's doing hard time now under, you know, lots of pavement. So
wow, that's amazing. All right, so they decide to build a Big Thunder, mm-hmm. and it gets built. But what about like Big Thunder Ranch and the transition into Fantasyland? What was over here on this side?
Okay, this is where the story gets a little strange, because again, we've talked about them wanting to build expansion, you know, expanding out into this part of the park. Because face it, that Disney Anaheim is in Orlando. There's a limited amount of land. There's a limited amount of, and more to the point, they were constantly looking for ways to expand capacity. And Tony had basically hit a home run with Big Thunder.
Yep.
And so the notion is, we have this land that abuts Fantasyland. What could we do, you know, to increase capacity of the park, but do consistent storytelling? And Tony actually came up with this ingenious idea that in the area that kind of abuts Toontown, he was going to build Dumbo Circus.
Okay.
All right, and literally, the idea of Dumbo Circus is, and again, no idea, good ideas ever die at Disney, so a bunch of these ideas have already been cribbed and are now in the storybook circus. But basically, you move the Dumbo spinner over to the center of this land, and you actually raise it up so you now have the height advantage and all that. But you do a Mickey's Funhouse attraction that's a celebration of the black and white shorts that Mickey did with the Pie-Eyed Mickey. You do a Circus Disney, which is a giant animatronic show where you basically see all of the Disney characters, you know. But, you know, for example, you have Horse Collar is the rubber man. Or, you know, you have the ballet dancer from Hippo Ballet Dancer is the fat lady in the circus. And, you know, it's the Disney circus is filtered through cartoon characters. But what you do is that you create connective tissue between this and your Frontierland transition, because you have an aerial balloon ride. And it was this fascinating... Well, it was this fascinating ride system. What they were going to do is that you would get on the balloon, and the balloon... There were no wires above the balloon. There was a rod that came up out of the ground, and it would just rode a ride track up the hill, but it would go up and down, kind of like a...
It's almost like characters in flight on a rail.
On a rail. That's it, exactly. Huh. But you'd come to the top of the hill, and you've now moved out of Dumbo Circus, and you've now reached Discovery Bay. And the idea is that... And a cunning bit of storytelling. The idea is that the gentleman who invented the mine rig, the drilling machine that actually dug all the tunnels in Big Thunder Mountain and took the gold out. He, you know, this inventor decided that, and in fact, his name was Jason Chandler. He was going to found a place where all of the great inventors of the world could come.
All right.
So he builds this city, which is really, you know, the sort of frontier town that's kind of modeled after San Francisco during the gold rush. In fact, there was a lot of talk about, during the height of the gold rush, a dozen eggs literally would cost you $20. I mean, you know, just they were taking advantage of the miners who had the money. But again, this was a place that celebrated inventors. So what they decided to do is like that people from far and wide would come here, and people like Captain Nemo. So, you know,
that was how they got them all together.
Yeah, so for example, you had in Discovery Cove, they were going to do a full-size recreation of the Nautilus. And what was great about it is you'd walk up the gangplank to the Nautilus, and you had the choice of going to the... You know, they literally were going to take Nemo's Salon and change it into the most elegant restaurant at Disneyland. And the idea, you know, you're in there eating in front of those giant windows, mm-hmm. and, you know, they were going to fill... You know, it's filled with tropical fish. It's just a wonderful, beautiful environment. Or you
Which
could
eventually became coral reef, but okay.
No, that's it exactly. That's it exactly. All right. You then went from there to, or you could continue down to the shuttle floor, and you literally could take a, you know, a board, the first simulator attraction Disney was ever going to do. You'd board this pod that would take you out into Discovery Bay, where you'd be attacked by squids, and, you know, this great fun ride in. But again, with the classic Disney case of you think you're going up below the water and you're actually ducking back in, you know, to a show building that's going to be built right up against the rivers of Rome.
Clever.
But the thing that was really going to drive the bus here was that there was going to be the Island on Top of the World attraction. And
Island on Top of the World.
Seriously, you were going to board the Hyperion. You were going to get on, you know, you're going to step into a show building that showed you a giant Zeppelin, and you were going to get into the carriage. And what you didn't realize is once you boarded, the carriage was basically an upside-down monorail. And you now, you know, you then begin to move through all of these Peter Pan-esque scenes, and you'd fly up to the north, and you're attacked by killer whales, and it was, and in fact, that was the saddest part of the story, that everyone agreed this was a wonderful thing, and it was a great design, and oh, I can't wait for us to build this, and as soon as that Islands of Adventure movie comes out and is a big smash hit, we're going to make this.
And then
it came out.
Yeah.
And that was 77, I want to say, and it died a dog's death, and it was just one of these things where what's kind of interesting, though, is that in that era of the company, you couldn't build an attraction around a failed film. Now, where this gets interesting is...
Really?
No, I mean, you just... But Walt, for example... I mean, Alice in Wonderland didn't make any money for the company. The company spent 20 years developing it. It came out, it was a flop. That didn't prevent... Walt recognized that these were great characters, so he had no problem with building the Mad Tea Party. He had no problem with putting an Alice ride in.
Sure.
And, you know, conversely, I mean, just today, for example, nobody remembers that when, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas came out, you know, that movie got really bad reviews and only made, like, $50 million and was actually... And you have to understand that 6 months later, The Lion King comes out and makes $312 million.
Yeah, yeah, so compared, it's...
Yeah, so it was like, no, we're not going to build anything about that. But now, I mean, at least the company has enough foresight. It's like, look, those are good characters. Let's do it for Mansion. And that's one of the hits of the parks for the holidays. I guess where this gets interesting is this is still recognized... This Big Thunder Ranch area is like... Big Thunder Ranch has been standing here basically as a hold. It's
I mean, if you think about it, this is... I mean, park land has to be at a premium, and everything to the left of Big Thunder between it and sort of the river, that's a huge expansion area. You could do a lot of stuff there.
Well, at one point, this was going to be the home of the Young Indiana Jones stunt show.
Dun, 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 dun.
You know, in fact, if you've seen the opening of The Last Crusade with the, you know, River Phoenix as the Boy Scout, they were going to reenact that here up to and including the race across the train. The train at Disneyland literally was going to be part of the show.
Clever. I don't know how they pull that up from a logistics perspective, but...
And then there was... It wasn't all that long ago that they were talking very seriously about this was going to be a Toy Story... themed land that was built around Woody, Buzz, and Jessie, you know, with four very, you know, small kid-friendly rides. And now, a lot depends right now on what happens with Oz the Great and Powerful, Disney's big
release. They did that, couldn't they?
This, for March of 2013. Plans have already been drawn up for, you know, an Oz-themed land that would be dropped back in here.
Oh, yeah, they could totally do that, because you could make the transition from sort of the West back to Kansas over here.
Yep, that's it. Exactly.
And then, you know, onto Oz if you needed to.
So, but again, everybody at the studio is kind of holding their breath.
Yeah, about Oz. So the trailer on it looks really good.
So, well, here's hoping.
All right, good. So that's what's coming up in the future then on Frontierland. For Jim Hill, this is Len Testa. Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Disney Dish Podcast with Jim Hill. We'll pick up in Fantasyland on the next show, but for now, thanks very much for listening. Don't forget to rate us on iTunes and leave comments on what else you'd like to hear Jim and I cover. Thanks, and have a great day.